Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This episode comes to you from the iconic Abbey Road Studios in London, where I had the honour of interviewing Merrick Stiles. Who's he? Well, he's the head of audio products at Abbey Road, who started out at the studios as a recording engineer, working on the likes of film scores like Lord of the Rings. He's something of an authority when it comes to exploring their film music archive. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Scala Radio, where every Saturday from 1 you can listen to my show about film music, in which I get to talk about movie scores of all kinds, and you can hear an eclectic mix of extraordinary film music. So, Merrick, firstly, tell me where we are.
We are at Abbey Road Studios in St. John's Wood in London.
And where particularly in Abbey Road are we?
We're in the mix stage. The Dolby accredited mix stage, Dolby Atmos accredited mix stage, is where the soundtrack for a film is put together, the final stages. So you've got the music, the dialogue and the sound effects. They all come together and you create the print master that goes out to the cinemas.
And tell me what your job is and what that entails.
My job here at Abbey Road currently is I'm known as the head of audio products. And what that means is I work with developers to create software that's based on some of our intellectual historic recording property and the acoustics of our rooms, so music production software. But I used to work in the studios as a recording engineer probably about 15 years ago now.
Okay, so the history of Abbey Road is of course extraordinary. We're now 90 years on from its inception. Tell me how Abbey Road first came about and why it was significant when it came about.
Well, the Gramophone Company, which was the first record label here in the UK, started in 1908 in a small kind of complex in Covent Garden next door to Rules Restaurant, I think it was. And a few years later, they'd started to build this massive complex over in Hayes in West London, because it kind of just took off, this kind of industry. It's still very new, but it was growing and growing.
Yeah.
And they were recording in any spaces they could find, whether that be church halls, town halls, even in the offices in Hayes or the factories in Hayes. They had a very small makeshift studio. But the idea of a purpose-built recording complex just didn't exist.
Right.
And I think it was just getting out of hand. They were using the Queen's Hall, which doesn't exist anymore, in Oxford Street. And they were just like, you know, we're getting more and more demand to do more and more recordings and we can't get the space. So there was a manager who worked for the Gramophone Company at the time, a guy called Trevor Osmond Williams, and he was like, let's just build a facility, which everyone thought he was mad, absolutely mad. Like, why would you do that? This, what we've got works, it's not perfect, but it works. No one's done it before, all that sort of stuff. But he convinced the Gramophone Company, the board of directors, that we needed to do this. So he started scouting around for a place to do it. And he found number 3 Abbey Road, which at the time was a 3-story townhouse.
Right.
But what happened was it came with this huge plot of land in the back, the gardens to the house. And the house next door was for sale with their gardens. So they bought the house and built the studios, the complex, in the grounds, the original grounds of the building. So that's why Abbey Road looks a bit weird. It looks like a house from the outside because it was.
Yeah.
And you walk through those doors and everything beyond reception was the original grounds of the house, the gardens and all that sort of stuff. So they built it from the ground up. I think they built They bought the house in 1928 and they were opened by 1931. The tragic thing is that Trevor Osmond Williams died at the age of 40 of a brain tumour in 1930. So he never actually got to see his realisation come to fruition, which is tragic, I think.
Wow. Now, you showed me a photograph of one of the first recording sessions in the studio, and you said what was remarkable about it is that the orchestra were all huddled together. So why would that have been the case back then? If you had a big space, why would you huddle the orchestra like that?
They were trying to recreate a concert hall. That's what people associate music with, a concert hall. So the audience are all sat down on the floor, there's a stage at the back, and the orchestra are all sort of crowded on the stage. And that's what they're trying to recreate, because that's what they knew, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think they quickly learnt that, you know, that's not going to work, and the staging went eventually, and they decided to use the whole of the floor, because it makes sense to do that. But this was like the early days of recording. No one had built a recording studio before, purpose-built recording studio. It actually inspired other labels to sort of follow suit. It was like, it really was quite an innovative kind of bold move, if you like.
Now, just before we started talking, we quickly walked around and we saw three studios. Studio One, which is, you know, enormous. Studio Two, which has all the Beatles history. Studio Three, which, as you pointed out, is where Pink Floyd recorded Wish You Were Here, although it's very different now. The differences between a fairly small recording room and that huge Studio One. What is the difference between recording in a small space and a great big cavernous space?
It's the overall sound at the end of the day. So generally speaking, a bigger space is going to have a larger reverb time, which is great for certain types of music, i.e. choral, orchestral, solo pianos, that sort of thing. If you put a band in there, like a rock and roll band, it can sound quite mushy quite quickly.
Right.
Because the sound's just bouncing around all over the place. So smaller rooms tend to be, like Studio 2 is kind of the perfect one in the middle. It's not too big, not too small. That's why Studio 2 is great for both recording smaller orchestras and for recording rock and roll bands. It kind of does a bit of both. Whereas Studio 3, I mean, you would do smaller string sessions in Studio 3, smaller string sections, but that's kind of a perfect band-sized room. So really it comes down to sound, the sound you're trying to get. It's about the reverbs and the acoustics.
And when you say the reverb, what you mean is the way in which the sound continues to ring after it has left the instrument, right?
Yes. So if you went down to Studio 1, if you clap your hand, it's got a 2.3-second reverb time. So basically, after that clap stopped, the tail was going to be about 2.3 seconds after, which doesn't sound like a huge amount, but it is in terms of when you're actually hearing that.
Yeah. So what's Abbey Road's history with soundtrack recordings? When does that really begin?
If you asked me about 2 months ago, I would have said 1981. And I will go into that. But recently, we found in the archives a recording sheet that was just simply titled Mia Farrow, Rosemary's Baby, in Studio 2, 1968. And what it was that the opening, really creepy opening piece. Exactly. Yeah, that was done in Studio 2. And I had no idea that, one, we ever did films before 1981, and what a interesting film to be done in Studio 2. And with John Barry as well. John Barry did a few bits and pieces here, but this wouldn't have been done to picture. So if you think of certainly a film recording session today, but most traditional film recording sessions, even going back to the early days of film, you would have some sort of picture playback in the room. None of that existed here at Abbey Road until 1981. So 1981 is when film, I would say, started proper. And the reason that came about was Studio One, the room we went into, massive big orchestral room built for classical music. The repertoire by the mid-70s had kind of pretty much all been recorded, and there wasn't a huge amount of new repertoire coming through, and that whole CD digital thing hadn't happened, where they basically came back and re-recorded everything anyway.
Yeah.
So there was this lull in the middle, and that room just wasn't being used. It was being used for games of badminton, five-a-side football, and
seriously,
it just wasn't being used, apart from things it probably shouldn't be used for. And, you know, the suits at EMI were like, you know, what is going on? You know, why are the numbers so low and all that sort of stuff? So, I mean, Ken Townsend, the studio manager at the time, was under huge amounts of pressure, and he knew he had to do something about it. And one of the plans that was drawn up, and if this had happened, I don't think we'd be sat here right now, they were going to divide Studio One up into two smaller pot rooms with underground car parking facilities. Because you've seen the car park, right? It's tiny. No one could park. So it's like, we need a car park, and Pop studios were like king at the time. London was full of them. And the trend for sound at that time was that very dry up front kind of Fleetwood Mac kind of Rumours sort of sound. You don't need a big space for that. So it was like, yeah, let's carve up Studio One and turn it into Pop Studios, which Ken was not happy about. And, you know, it's a historic room. It's a great sounding room, you know. And by a complete stroke of luck, there used to be a film studio over in Denham Film Studios, which had been around since the 30s, where they did Brief Encounter and Great Expectations and stuff like that. And there was a sound department over in Denham called Anvil, which was headed up by legendary film engineer Eric Tomlinson.
Yeah.
Anyway, the lease was up on their building. This was around about 1980. I mean, they hadn't shot a film there for donkey's years, and it was slowly being knocked down bit by bit, but they managed to hold on to the bitter end, Anvil, until they were literally told, you've got to get out of it. You're out, basically, with turning into a shopping centre or whatever.
Yeah.
So Eric was just like looking around, like, where can we find a place to, you know, carry on doing like very successful business. They did. Eric recorded Alien, Superman, the first Star Wars, The Omen, you know. He was the guy, and this was his business.
He had a background in aeronautics, right? He worked for Ferry Aviation. Right.
Yeah. A very interesting guy. So it was him and his assistant, Alan Snelling, and they had no home anymore. And I don't know who approached who, but Ken, Alan, and Eric got together, and they said, like, we can do this. We can do a joint venture in Studio One. We've got the space. We've got the microphones. You bring the projection equipment. Bring the clients. And let's do this. So they started Anvil Abbey Road Screen Sound, it was called, in 1981. The first film was Miklos Rosa film, Eye of the Needle.
Yeah. There's a question about whether it was that or whether Lion was actually before. They were around about the same time, right?
Yeah, so what's it called? The Lion in the Desert.
Lion in the Desert.
Anyway, yeah, there was a question mark as to which film was first. I think what they may have done is they may have started Lion at Anvil and then just done some overdubs here and mixed it here. But the first actual beginning to end score done here was Miklos Rosa. I mean, what a fantastic start. You know, legend. So that's how it came about. And then a couple of films after that was Alex North's Dragon Slayer, Michael Kamen's Venom, and then the fourth film to be done here was a little ditty called Raiders of the Lost Ark.
So tell us about that, because, I mean, obviously this is the kind of a milestone in Abbey Road's history. Why was that score here in the first place, and what's important about it?
I think the reason the score came here would have been because of the relationship that John Williams had with Eric Tomlinson, without a shadow of a doubt. So this was the early days of film scoring for Abbey Road, obviously, so we're still trying to prove ourselves. I'm pretty sure John Williams would have been familiar with the acoustics of Studio One anyway, and obviously knew the London musicians, because they would have gone over to Anvil. So I'm pretty sure John would have known he was in a safe pair of hands. But yeah, that's how it came about. It was, you know, it was a film that John wanted to work on with Eric, and Eric said, well, I'm now here at Abbey Road, and that's how it happened.
Can you explain, you know, you've talked a lot about Eric Tomlinson. Can you explain what the relationship would be like if you were actually in the studio recording that? What would the relationship between the conductor, the composer, the engineer be? How would it describe for us what an actual session like that would be like?
A session, well, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, for a start, it would have been a very cramped session. So this was the early days of scoring Abbey Road, and Abbey Road wasn't set up to do film scoring. So it was kind of shoehorned in, if you like. So the control room for Studio One at the time was side orientated from the recording space. So what I mean by that is that speakers would be facing one way and the window looking out to the musicians would be facing the other way. And that's kind of where the film would be projected, on the back of the room. So I think it was quite frustrating for a Hollywood director or composer who was used to the big scoring stages in the States to come into Studio One. I mean, I think Steven Spielberg famously, well, not famously said, but I heard he said that he was stood in Studio One. He was like, well, which direction do you want me to face, the speakers or the screen? You know, you couldn't do both. So I guess it must have been frustrating. So I guess from Eric's point of view, maybe those early days were kind of frustrating because he'd come from Anvil, which was a purpose-built recording facility. Yeah. But anyway, his job at the end of the day was to capture the orchestra, or whatever it is recording, with the cinema in mind. He would use this bespoke microphone techniques to kind of fill the theatre and create that exciting widescreen kind of sound, which he became very famous for. And his job was to technically capture what the composer's intent was and also appease what the director's intent was, kind of a go-between, I suppose.
And you've said that that score is classic Tomlinson, the way when you listen to it you can hear Eric Tomlinson's influence on it.
Yeah, I generally think that is a landmark kind of recording, if you like, that I'm pretty sure to this day most scoring engineers listen back to and use it as a reference point. It just sounds fantastic. So, 1982, Jerry Goldsmith does First Blood, and at the point that he does it, it's the sixth thing that he's done in 1982.
Yeah, he was in demand.
So, describe for me Jerry Goldsmith's process, because the output is extraordinary, and when you look at how much he created in that, you know, a comparatively brief period of time, what was he like as a conductor and composer?
I mean, if we compare Raiders of the Lost Ark with First Blood. I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark is, they're both orchestral scores,
yep,
but Raiders of the Lost Ark is very traditional from the point of view. It's the orchestra, everything's being played live, very little overdubs from what I knew about how John Williams worked. Whereas Jerry, he would like to use synthesizers as well. So he would obviously have traditional orchestral arrangements and sounds, but he would blend in synthesizers underneath and kind of get a slightly different texture. So if you listen to maybe the soundtrack to First Blood, the kind of piano riff, it's quite obviously a piano, but there's a synth mixed in underneath, and it makes it sound very distinctive, and you can't quite put your finger on what it exactly is. And that's the point, I guess, is to kind of give you that kind of otherworldly experience or sound, I suppose.
Do you have a favourite Jerry Goldsmith score?
I like First Blood. I think it's a great score. I mean, Alien, probably, I would say, because it just is. It's a brilliant score.
Okay.
Which, tragically, I don't think a lot of it was actually used in the final film.
No.
That was a kind of one of those spotting kind of temp score issues where the director falls in love with the temp score and doesn't end up using.
Yes, described as not a happy experience. We'll talk about Aliens in a little bit.
Yeah, speaking of unhappy experiences.
Yeah. So 83 is Return of the Jedi. The first two Star Wars movies aren't recorded here. Is that right?
No. There was a bit of toing and froing and conflicting recollections of if Empire was done here. Empire Strikes Back. But
yeah,
we're pretty sure it didn't. It was Anvil. Yeah. Maybe they did a few bits and pieces here and finished it off here. That same thing with Lion. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that they're all done at Anvil. So the first Star Wars film done here was Return of the Jedi. And it kind of makes sense. I mean, if you go on to like Spotify, for example, and just play that opening cue from New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi, Return of the Jedi does actually sound sonically quite different. It sounds a bit more widescreen, a bit lusher. Nothing against the Anvil sound,
but no,
I mean, the scoring stage at Anvil, I imagine, was a very different beast to what you got down in Studio One.
Because we can obviously play these to put them together to kind of experience that. What are we listening for that's different in the Jedi sound?
It's like New Hope, that opening of New Hope versus the opening of Jedi. I would say New Hope just sounds smaller, doesn't sound quite as widescreen, quite as lush, if that kind of makes sense. Whereas Return of the Jedi, it's you hear that opening kind of chord. It's just like I witnessed that a couple of years ago. We were doing a test recording for a game, one of the Star Wars games, and we asked the LSO. It was the LSO to play. You know, do you mind just playing the Star Wars theme tune for us? And I was stood behind the conductor, and I kind of wasn't ready for the moment. I don't know what I was doing. I was maybe adjusting something, and it just bam, and I was literally like blown back, like the air was rushing past my hair. And when they finished, even members of the orchestra had a bit of a smirk on their face.
Right, let's put Mirek's theory to the test. Here's the opening of the first Star Wars film, Episode 4, A New Hope. And here's the third film, Return of the Jedi. I think he makes a good point. And then the prequels were recorded here, I presume?
Yeah, I think all but one. So the three prequels in around the 90s, they were done here. And then some of the spin-offs and some of the newer films, I think a lot of them were done here, maybe apart from one. But yeah, all the prequels were done here, yeah.
I mean, I wonder what it must have been like coming back to the Star Wars theme, you know, because
having, we all grew up with that, you know, oh yes, the idea that, oh, it's, you know, 4, 5, and 6. Is it? Oh, apparently it is. And I remember going to America, especially to see Phantom Menace. I mean, I wonder what it must have been like coming back to the Star Wars themes after all that time.
I mean, even members of, certain members of the orchestra were on those Phantom Menace sessions, were on the original Star Wars session, like Morris Murphy, the trumpet player. He was on those sessions. So I think for everyone involved, or for a few people involved, there was a lot of memories going back to the very beginning. And like, wow, we're back again. We're doing this again. And it was a massive deal here at the studios when it came in. I mean, there was such a buzz around that film anyway. Like, it was so secretive, and the security was crazy, quite rightly so, I suppose. You know, if you weren't actually directly involved in that session, you weren't allowed to go anywhere near Studio One. And they, they hired security guards. And I remember at the end of the sessions, one of the technical engineers that literally had to get a saw and was sawing the videotapes in half. And then bulk erasing them and then sending them back to prove that, you know, they were destroyed, basically. It was like proper kind of secret squirrel sort of stuff.
Which is also particularly extraordinary because I've talked to journalists who worked on the first Star Wars film who said, you wander on an offset. I mean, everyone just thought it was like a little, you know, it was a Buck Rogers thing and nobody thought it was such a big deal. So that whole change from what happened from Star Wars to Phantom Menace is extraordinary. But there must have been a feeling of it coming home. I mean, to be back in Abbey Road.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. You know, Abbey Road, you know, Studio One, the LSO, John Williams is back. And also, it's the way John Williams works. You know, it's like, it's everything in the room at the same time.
No overdubs.
Hardly any overdubs. You've got a full orchestra, like probably like an 80-piece orchestra, say. And then you've probably got a 60-piece choir at the back of the room. And you've got a lot of bodies in that room. And then you've got the music editors and the engineers and the runners and the assistant engineer. You know, seriously busy session going on there. It must have been like, speaking to the people who did a work on it, you know, it was a buzz. It was a huge buzz.
Now, one of my favourite films, and certainly one of my favourite soundtracks of all time, is the soundtrack to Brazil, the Terry Gilliam film. And one reason I love it so much is I think that the album stands up completely on its own. It has a kind of, because it has a unifying theme all the way through it. Tell us what was different about Abbey Road by the time Michael Kamen got to come and do Brazil here.
I spoke earlier on about the dodgy control room, as it were.
Yeah, sideways on. Sideways on. Look in the same place.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were a lot of stern letters written from clients, as it were, saying, you guys will get your act together a bit, you know, if you want us to carry on coming to Abbey Road. You know, I mean, obviously now it's a state-of-the-art film scoring facility, but back then, like I said, we were still finding our feet with it. Anyway, eventually something was done, and that's what they basically tore that control room out and built this brand-new control room, state-of-the-art, bigger mix and console. I mean, The recording console they used to record Raiders of the Lost Ark, for example, and Return of the Jedi, was pretty much a hand-me-down from the Beatles' recording desk. You know? It was the TG Mark III, whereas the TG Mark I was used to record Abbey Road. It wasn't designed to do film music. It just wasn't. So anyway, so Michael Kamen, that was the first session with the brand-new control room. I think the trend then was to use a video player back instead of big projection. So it's a bit more leaner sort of operation, if you know what I mean, sort of a bit smaller, and, you know, there wasn't 35mm projection going on and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, God, I think that was like kind of 80s excess, if you like. I think Michael Kamen was here for about 13 weeks doing that score and used pretty much every studio here. I mean, I think he worked on the score for like 6 months with Ray Cooper. Because I think Terry Gilliam asked Michael Kamen to base the entire score on an old Brazilian song, Aquilera do Brasil.
Yeah, which is an absolutely beautiful song.
Yeah.
About somebody, the memories drifting back to them on a hot summer night, which of course is the central theme of Gilliam's Brazil, which is that in the end, your mind will take you somewhere else.
Yeah, but imagine someone saying, can you base your entire score on this, please? I mean, what a task. And I think Michael Kamen was so concerned about the publishing rights that he hired specialists to listen to all the cues he'd written to sort of try and work it out and see who's owed what with. And I think he was pleasantly surprised that they said, we can't really see a huge amount of resemblance. I mean, but he still managed to capture the essence of it. I mean, what a skill that is to be able to do that. But yeah, 6 months of working on that and then 13 weeks in here. I mean, I would love to have been in those sessions, though. I mean, Terry Gilliam, Ray Cooper and Michael Kamen. I mean, wow, that must have been amazing.
You say 13 weeks as a really lengthy session. How long would a session usually be for recording an orchestral score for a film?
I mean, it varies considerably, but for example, I think Return of the Jedi, they were here for 10 days. I mean, yeah, a week is probably normal.
Okay, so 13 weeks is insanely long.
Absolutely, but it was the 80s, you know, I guess, yeah, kind of what happened back then, I suppose.
Also, I would say that album still holds up.
Oh.
If you listen to it, it sounds like something somebody may have taken 13 weeks, but hey, it's brilliant.
It's a brilliant film, brilliant soundtrack, very creative from both sides, obviously visually, but also in terms of the music. I mean, Michael Kamen was using all sorts, like kazoos and using typewriters as percussion and all, just really creative, yeah, scoring. Just, yeah, it's still, and like I say, it still stands up. It sounds great.
Was there any sense, because I mean, obviously, one of the things that the Beatles were doing was, you know, to experiment with sounds. And I mean, I just have this idea of Michael Kamen there going, you know, dun 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 dun, tick 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 tick, that it's a kind of similar, well, let's try it and see what flies.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of that goes on. You can't help yourself. Once you're in that, I think once you're in that, if you've got the time, this is the thing, I suppose. I mean, traditionally, film scoring sessions, you're kind of, you're up against it in terms of you've got an orchestra out there in the room, which is not cheap, you know,
yeah, yeah,
and you've got a certain amount of time to get all this music down. And, you know, sometimes you get the impression, you know, the clock is ticking, we're running out of time here and we've got to get this done. So unfortunately, most film scores, you're not going to get a chance to experiment much here in, yeah, the studio when you've got an orchestra sat out in the room, because that is not the time to do it. Having said that, obviously scores have always been very experimentation, you know, lots of experimentation goes on in scores traditionally,
yeah,
but you wouldn't necessarily do that here unless it's something out of the ordinary, like Michael Kamen spending 13 weeks here. then you got some time to do that, I suppose.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, we mentioned Alien, and I said, look, we'll talk about aliens.
Yeah.
The story is that the Aliens score recording was tough. Tell me why it was tough.
Again, like how much time do you have to record a score, right? I don't think James Horner had much time at all for that project. The story goes was he turned up to the UK expecting to have a locked picture, or more or less a locked picture, yeah, and he gave himself 6 weeks to write the score, which is a perfectly reasonable amount of time for a composer to write a score. And when he turned up, not only had they not edited the film, they were still shooting the film. I mean, there's all sorts of stories about what went wrong, and I think James Cameron was just kind of used to a more guerrilla style of filmmaking, you know, off the back of Terminator, and turned up to Pinewood Studios, and it was like very unionized and whatnot, and he was getting frustrated that there were all these tea breaks going on and elaborate long lunches in the pub and all that sort of stuff, and it just fell behind. There was problems with some of the cast, I think, and the director of photography wasn't lighting things the way he wanted, so it all basically fell apart. And when he sacked the director of photography, I think there was mutiny on the set, and I think he had to actually screen Terminator to the crew, because it hadn't been released here yet, to prove his credentials. It's like, look, I can make a film. Anyway, they got it all resolved, but by the time they did all that, they were like weeks behind. So James Horner turned up and he went to the editing rooms, and there was just bins of film everywhere. there was nothing for him to work to. He said it was a nightmare. I mean, obviously he could write themes and melodies, but he couldn't lock anything. He couldn't structure anything because there was nothing to work with. So this went on and on and on. And they booked the dates in Studio One, and his job was just to make sure that those musicians had some music to play. You know, I think by the time the sessions came around, what they were recording just wasn't working to the picture they were seeing. So they got it done. They recorded it, and in the dub, they, you know, edited it and truncated it and did what they had to do to make it work. I think they even took some music from the original Alien to fill in bits and pieces and what sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, it was still nominated for an Oscar, and it's still a fantastic, amazing film. Yeah. Great score. So I guess it's just goes to show, you know, no matter how wrong things seem to be going, you can still create this amazing piece of art at the end of it.
When you talk about them playing to picture and the thing not matching the picture, just explain this for us. Obviously, originally, pictures would be projected. Once you start to get with video playback, do you have a timeline on the video that tells you where you are in the scene to hit certain beats? How does that work?
Yeah, there's a system, they call it a streaming device. So yeah, the conductor if the composer's conducting will be out in the room on the podium with the music in front, and then a screen as well. And as the scene is being played out, you'll get these streamers. So it's a line that goes across the screen, and it's just to remind everyone there's an extenuating point coming up, and we've got to hit it.
Yeah,
it's just another tool you have to kind of help guide you through the recording process. But there's, you know, musicians will have a click track as well. Everything's done to click, so there's a metronome going. So everything's obviously locked to the action on the screen. So when a monster jumps out or whatever, you know, there's a piece of music that extenuates that and all that sort of stuff. So
are all film scores recorded to click track pretty much now?
Yeah, they are now. Traditionally, I guess not. If you think of films in the 30s, 40s, 50s, or even up to the 60s or 70s, they just got on with it. I think they would use stopwatches, actually, in the early days. That's how they get around it.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Braveheart, which is, you know, Mel Gibson's film, which went on to win the Oscar for Best Picture. When they were recording the Braveheart score here, the story is that the Beatles were in overseeing Anthology, I suppose, wasn't
it? Yeah.
And that they were asked if they wanted to go and meet the director. Do you want to fill in the rest of this story?
Yeah, I mean, I think those sessions were pretty full on. Again, big orchestra. James Horner loved to have 35mm projection or at least...
Oh, fine, so he wasn't using videos?
No, or at least a video projector. He liked to have projection up on the room. Right. You know, cause it completely changes the mood and the atmosphere when you kind of got a big screen 35mm projection, if you like, on the back of the room and the orchestra's playing to it. It's an amazing experience.
And presumably you then have to darken the orchestra.
Yeah,
and
you sort of bring the lights down. There's little, each of the musicians got little lamps over their music. And then there was Ian Underwood was doing the synths for that score, I think, who was Frank Zappa's keyboard player. So the room was just full of synthesizers. It was just a chaos. I've seen pictures of this control. It's just chaos, basically. Absolute chaos. You've got Mel Gibson as the director, you know. I mean, and then in the monks...
The famously low-played and easy to manage Mel Gibson.
Absolutely. And then in the middle of all that, then the Beatles walk into the control room and everyone was just like, what the hell? You know, they're probably in the middle of recording a cue. I mean, only the Beatles could stop a cue being recorded by an orchestra. You know, the clock's ticking, you know, this orchestra's costing a fortune, but the Beatles are here. Okay, we'll stop now. And I think they looked around and said hello to Mel and all that sort of stuff. And then as they were leaving, Ringo Starr said, I thought we were going to meet Mel Brooks. nice cheeky one there, I like it.
What do you think it is about the Braveheart score that the sound, why is the sound of the Braveheart score different? I mean, I remember, I'm not a huge fan of the film, but I think the music is fantastic.
The soundtrack is epic, let's say.
And is it because it has everything and the kitchen sink, or what is it that makes it special?
So you've got traditional orchestral elements, choirs, but also a lot of more traditional kind of old medieval sounding flutes and just kind of unusual sounding instruments that you weren't used to hearing in most film scores. I think that's what it was. I think that stemmed from originally they were going to try and do like a medieval sounding score entirely. And I think both Mel Gibson and James Horner quickly worked out that would sound pretty horrendous. You know, it can sound quite harsh, right, I suppose, if you had just purely those instruments. So what they did was they had traditional orchestral and choirs and all that sort of stuff, and then blended some of those instruments in and So it's like more of a solo, but not in its entirety. So yeah, it's still pleasant to listen to.
I'd forgotten how epic it was, but I'd also forgotten how much that kind of, you know, old world, new world, that those two things are. And actually, I think it's the thing that makes the film interesting is that the score has an old world, new world thing about it, which sometimes the film itself doesn't have. The film just has the anachronistic haircut and you wonder why Mel Gibson looks like that. But the score almost makes sense of all those warring elements in the film. It is a brilliant score. It is the best thing about the film.
I mean, they recorded a lot of material, I think, because they released two albums out of it.
Like, yes, there was more music from
more
Braveheart.
More music from Braveheart, because they recorded so much.
And it's not like it was a short film in the first
place.
Exactly,
yeah. So they must have been pretty full-on sessions, I imagine.
So let's talk a little bit about Stanley Kubrick. Jocelyn Pook's first film score was for Kubrick after Kubrick heard a piece of music that he was interested in. What do you know about Eyes Wide Shut? And the reason I ask you what do you know is because everything surrounding Kubrick is shrouded in utter secrecy. I mean, you talk about the secrecy of the Star Wars movies. Nothing would match the secrecy of any Kubrick project. So what can you tell us about Eyes Wide Shut?
So, yeah, Jocelyn Pook did about 30 minutes worth of music here for that film, which unfortunately was, you know, turned out to be his last film. And that came about because they were rehearsing the masked ball scene, I think, and the choreographer had all sorts of music playing to sort of try out, and Jocelyn Pook's Backward Priests came on.
Which is really demonic sounding.
God, yeah.
It's like a kind of invocation of some unholy spirit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really interesting piece. And Stanley Kubrick was like, what is this? I want more of it. Who made it? You know, all that sort of stuff. You know, find me this composer, as it were. And it was Jocelyn Pook, and Jocelyn Pook got a phone call from Stanley Kubrick's people saying Stanley would like to hear more of your music, completely out of the blue, apparently. I mean, I don't think Jocelyn Pook had worked on any film music ever. So imagine that, probably in her early 20s, suddenly being asked to, well, one, provide music for Stanley Kubrick, like the Stanley Kubrick. And then the next day, she went to go and meet him, and Stanley gave her the gig, like to, you know, can you please record some more music to my film, as it were. So came down here to Abbey Road with I think it was a really small ensemble, like maybe like sort of eight or so musicians.
Yeah.
And Stanley wasn't here. From what I can tell, Stanley wasn't here. He just let her get on with it. And came up with this, you know, 30 minutes of music. And, you know, a lot of it was used in the film. I just can't imagine being in that position where you're suddenly asked to do something you'd never done before with probably the most famous director in the world, with a film with A-list couple, all that sort of stuff. It's just like, what a huge thing to be asked to do. And absolutely nailing it as well. I mean, I think she did a fantastic job. It's they recorded strings over the Backward Priests here at Abbey Road. And just watching that scene, the music is just brilliant. I mean, the scene's very interesting, obviously, in its own right, but the music is brilliant, and it's one of those pieces of film music which I think is just very memorable and very interesting, and I love it. I listen to it, and I think it's brilliant.
It's interesting that you think that Kubrick didn't come to the session, because, I mean, obviously, you know, Kubrick is famously reclusive. And one of the stories about Kubrick is you wouldn't know if he was there anyway, because he used to famously go and hang out in Ryman's in St. Albans, and nobody had any idea that he was Stanley Kubrick.
Excellent.
So are you convinced that he wasn't there?
No, I'm not. Maybe he was there, just sat in the back of the room, keeping an eye on things.
So tell me about, let's talk about Harry Potter, because Harry Potter is, you know, such a big part of everybody's sort of film consciousness. How does Harry Potter connect with Abbey Road?
Every film apart from the first two was recorded here at Abbey Road. So John Williams scored the first three films, and he did the third one here. I mean, I don't know why exactly he didn't do the first two here. He did them in London. I think he recorded them at Air Studios, which is a fantastic studio.
Yeah.
Lots of composers who love using Air will sometimes come to Abbey Road and vice versa if they can't get into one or the other. All that sort of stuff goes on. So, you know, they're good friends. Anyway, so the first two films weren't done here, and the third film was. I mean, it's just a very interesting series, I think, from the point of view that trying to keep any sort of consistency throughout eight films with multiple directors and multiple composers is going to be pretty much a nigh on impossible task. But I think it's really interesting that the third film, which John Williams did compose, I don't know if it was his way of cleaning the slate, but he didn't use a lot of the motifs and themes that he created in the first two films. I don't know whether that was a direction for him or him himself saying, look, I'm not going to do the rest of the series. Maybe I'm just going to give everyone a clear slate here and basically just not reuse what I've used in the past for the first two films. And because the other composers that went on to work on the series didn't. They all added their own unique styles. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, if you listen to the very first film and then John Williams, it's very John Williams and very big and orchestral and sort of lush strings and whatnot. And then you listen to the last couple of films of Alexandre Desplat, and it's like it's a lot darker and moodier. Yeah. And it's definitely a progression throughout that series. And it's quite interesting to sort of listen to that progression. Also, I mean, visually as well, they changed a lot.
There's also an interesting thing that audiences grew up with the Harry Potter movies. So the people who were watching the sort of more light-hearted movies at the beginning, by the time they get to Deathly Hallows and Harry on Camping and all those kind of, those really sort of dark movies, they've grown up with them. And I think there is an evolution of the films from the light to the dark, which is from being young to being older, which is, as you say, mirrored in the scores. Do you ever do the thing of sitting down and thinking, I'll just listen to a selection of Harry Potter's?
I've never done that, actually, no. I haven't seen all the films, to be totally honest. I know,
that's
terrible.
That's a terrible confession.
Terrible, terrible. I've dotted around I've never listened to all the scores, but I have dotted around the scores just to hear the difficulty, because I'm interested in how they progressed musically over the years and hearing that difference from kind of light to dark, if you like. But no, I haven't actually sat down and watched all of them or listened to all of them back to back. Has anyone done that? I'm sure they have, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure people have done that. So if not sitting down and doing all the Harry Potters, would you ever sit down and do all the Lord of the Rings?
I was forced to, because I worked on the Lord of the Rings films. So, yeah, I am.
So you literally did. Tell us about your involvement.
I did all three. Lord of the Rings was kind of like our version of Apocalypse Now, I suppose. We had access to too much time, too much money, and little by little we went insane.
Which is still the best quote ever made by a director about filmmaking.
Heart of Darkness, great
absolutely,
documentary.
Absolutely.
I'm kind of joking, but not. I mean, yeah, it was really interesting experience. I mean, amazing experience. I mean, I was the assistant mix engineer. So my job was to assist the mix engineer and capture the final mixes and deliver them down to New Zealand. We had this thing called the Fat Pipe setup, which in 2001 was mind-blowing, that I could drag a folder onto this server and they could just drag it off the other end down in New Zealand sort of thing. It took like about an hour.
So would Peter be in New Zealand?
So Peter Jackson was here for quite a big chunk of the recording, but just because of the nature of those films, I mean, he was always cutting the film. So we mentioned earlier on with things like Aliens, for example, it's a bit of a nightmare from a composer's point of view when you haven't got locked picture. I mean, quite often you get picture which is bound to move around a little bit, in this case, I think what happened was Howard Shaw wanted to work on this film in a very traditional kind of way. So he would write the score, compose using pen and paper,
right?
He would orchestrate it himself and he would conduct it himself. And the problem being, I suppose, was that Peter Jackson was always cutting the picture, always cutting it. So Howard would score to a version of this scene, go and record it, we would mix it, send it down to New Zealand, and then Peter Jackson would recut that scene or add completely new bits and pieces. So what Howard wanted to do was he wanted to re-score to that and re-record to that and then remix it. So we'd go around in this circle of picture gets cut, score gets recorded, score gets mixed, picture gets cut. This went round and round and round until the music executives at New Line Cinema said, we're print mastering this tomorrow. It's got to go back to the cinemas. That's it, you're done. And it just went round like that until it went round in circles until someone pulled the plug. That was the first film. And then obviously the first one was a massive success. So it just got worse for the second film. I mean, the second film I did 87 days without a day off. It was just mammoth, absolutely mammoth. But having said that, it was an amazing experience, a really positive experience most of the time. You know, great team. I mean, Peter Jackson, the films were amazing. Howard Shore, the music is stunning. The teams involved, you know, we all became friends, and it was a really, really amazing experience. I mean, I was just super excited on the first film anyway, because like Peter Jackson, I was a fan of like Bad Taste and like, you know, Meet the Feebles and all that sort of stuff. I was like, Peter Jackson's doing the Lord of the Rings films, really? And but, I mean, well, God, he nailed it. I mean, yeah.
I interviewed Peter when Bad Taste was first out. It was a tiny little distributor called Blue Dolphin. And I've still got a tape of me interviewing him upstairs in a dingy little hotel. And him saying, you got to understand the secret to the movie is squelchy yogurt. He said, you get yogurt and you put it in your hands, you go, it gives you all the gore that you want. And the idea that that guy then went on to make the biggest movie franchise of all time is still astonishing to me. I also had the great pleasure of interviewing Howard Shore on stage at the Edinburgh Festival. Incredibly genial.
Absolutely, yeah.
Describe him for me.
He's just a really kind of inspiring person to work with. Just his, I don't know, his writing, he was very like, I want to do this from a traditional point of view, and he had this vision. I think he was like treating it like this is going to be like an opera or something like that, you know, like he had this vision of what this wanted to be, and just the kind of the creative kind of collaborations he did as well with, you know, like Emiliano Cherini and Annie Lennox, and kind of, you know, it just went into all these different directions you didn't really necessarily expect it to, but it still just sounded like Lord of the Rings. It still just sounded like this Middle Earth world that he created musically.
When you're in the process of mixing something of the magnitude of, I mean, forgive me if I'm wrong, I'm imagining that Lord of the Rings is a massive undertaking. How do you approach, is that like, is it worryingly large, or is it you approach it the same way as you would approach anything else?
I do remember, like, we had a pre-meeting before the first film. It was almost like the studio manager at the time and music exec from New Line was basically sort of saying to us, warning us, like, this is going to be pretty full on, everyone. And I remember, like, walking out of the meeting and sort of one of those moments of, like, oh, my God, what am I getting myself in for here? Like, I'd never experienced anything like it before. Like I say, like, most film jobs, you'd be in and out in a week.
unless it's Brazil.
Unless it's Brazil, of course. But so yeah, I do remember that kind of thing at the beginning of some people saying, like, this is going to be quite a beast, be ready, sort of thing.
Do you have a favourite moment from the Lord of the Rings score?
I really love the end credits to The Two Towers, the Emiliano Torini track. Yeah. I think it's just beautiful.
What do you love about it?
The lyrics, I love Emiliano Torini's voice, and the music, it just comes together beautifully. And still, when I listen to that piece of music, it kind of gives me that kind of hairs on the back of your head sort of standing up, all that sort of stuff. It's a lush piece of music, yeah.
Where once was light, now darkness falls. Where once was love is no more. Don't say goodbye.
I'm aware that time is getting on. I want to ask you a little bit about Black Panther. Tell us about the Black Panther sessions and why it is that Black Panther is a remarkable score.
It's a very different sort of sounding score, I suppose, to what you would traditionally associate a superhero score. Kind of Ludwig Göransson was very, very adamant that he wanted to, he went over to Africa for like a few months and kind of wanted to absorb the kind of the music culture, if you like, the traditional music culture. And I think he fell in love with like the drums and the talking drums, and that was used heavily in the score. And it was one of those things where normally you would kind of do an orchestral score and then add those elements on top, whereas I think this was completely flipped over, where he was almost adding the orchestra on top of the traditional African style instruments. So, and the way he weaves them into each other, like the waterfall fight scene, for example, just starts off with these crazy drums, and it's like, it's really engrossing and sort of drags you into this rhythmic pulse. And then halfway through, suddenly the orchestra weaves in, and I don't know, I just think it's really sort of quite expertly crafted score, really, and just a very fresh sounding score, if that makes sense.
And when you listen to that score, can you hear that it's recorded at Abbey Road?
Strings, yes. And you, also the percussion as well, actually, on that waterfall scene, actually, when you've got the talking drums and stuff playing, but every so often you'll get these like big bam bams coming in. And it's that you can hear that Studio One basically percussion just like basically exploding in the room. So yeah, you do get that every so often, that you kind of hear a bit of that Studio One fingerprint.
This is what we were talking about at the beginning, about that, you know, 2 second, whatever it is, for how long the sound lingers in the room. So you can hear that when you hear a piece of music that's recorded there still.
I mean, the Pepsi Challenge and all that, I suppose. Yeah. It'd be a good test to do. But no, some occasionally, you know, you do hear it, like things like Raiders, Return of the Jedi, you know, elements of, you know, more modern scores like Black Panther 1917, Gravity. No, you can hear that Abbey Road sound, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about 1917. So 1917 is an extraordinary undertaking, because the film is essentially, and it isn't, but it looks like it's one shot.
Yeah.
So tell us about the different challenge of recording the score for a film which is essentially one take.
You know, most directors will use the editing process to set the pace of that scene, if you like, whether it's going to be fast or slow. Whereas you didn't have that option in this film. There was no editing as such. So the reliance was on the composer, Thomas Newman, to kind of create that feeling of whether it needs to be like a faster paced feeling or a slower paced feeling, or that was the music. Created the pulse, if you like. I mean, it does to a certain extent anyway, but there was no edits to help you get that experience. It was all completely down to the musical score. I mean, what an undertaking. I mean, obviously Sam Mendes had an undertaking himself with shooting it, but in that style, but also from Thomas Newman's point of view, is like, okay, I'm doing a score here, and I'm basically responsible for setting the entire pace of the film to a certain degree.
How do composers compare working here, for example, with working in, you know, American studio recordings? Because you said at the beginning, you know, American studio recordings, big spaces before. Do you have, do people talk to you about the different experience of recording here at Abbey Road?
I mean, look, there's loads of great studios around the world, loads of great scoring stages around the world. But Abbey Road's unique. I guess the experience is unique from the point of view, you know, if you're a composer, you're kind of one, you've got the London based musicians who are, you know, probably, you know, some of the best in the world, let's face it. And then you've got the sounds of the studio. Studio One has got a very unique sound. Studio Two has got another very unique sound. So it's like the acoustics of the rooms. And then you've got the you know, the engineers and the service they provide, and just the vibe they provide, and the technical capabilities. And then you kind of mix that all up with just the sense of history, you know, that this building has placed, you know, milestones of music history have happened here. So you kind of add that into the fold, and you kind of get a very unique experience. And I think a lot of composers a lot of new composers come through the doors every year, and they generally sort of come back again. They come back. I mean, I think Alexandre Desplat's on his like 35th film here now. You know, I mean, For some composers, it's like a family, I suppose. It's a you know, place where they feel comfortable, and it's a good place to be.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this Abbey Road special with Mirek Stiles. Thanks for downloading this Kermit on Film podcast. If you did enjoy it, remember to subscribe, tell your friends, and visit our Patreon page where there are loads of extras. And do listen to my Scala radio show. Tune in every Saturday afternoon at 1 for 2 hours of unmitigated musical joy, with regular features like best end credits music, dialogue on soundtracks, the triple bill, and my favourite, atonal squonk fests. Keep watching the skies and stay safe.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club, with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.